It's the smooth sounds of Good Papa Radio, KGPOP, OPA, with your hosts, Dad Paxis and Rob, the happiest of hobbits.
Gossiping Good Papa Radio, brought to you by Big Deked Enterprises. We'll get you there, possibly in a different coach this time.
A better coach.
Or on a boat.
Or on a boat.
Last episode, they were on a boat.
Which is like a coach for the land.
It is like a water coach.
It's a water coach, yes.
Is, as Bruno said, yes. And a coach is like a land boat.
And tuna is the chicken of the sea. No, I got it backwards. I completely
chicken
screwed
that
up.
Chicken are the tuna of the land.
Chicken
yes.
are the tuna of the land. Okay, I'm getting there. Been a long day,
and
folks.
Fish are the things that walk out of the river, and you wait and club them as they get up on the side of the river.
I still want to know if they eat them, in all honesty.
No, Lucky says they don't.
Probably bitter.
Probably bitter, a little slimy, and they have human faces. So, I mean...
Lucky has not had a childhood I would envy in any... way, shape,
no,
or form.
No. You know what might be fun is maybe when we get at some point to like maybe episode, I mean, maybe we'll get to an episode 50, I don't know. But if we get an episode where maybe we can get one of the players on and like just interview them in character, like we're interviewing their characters, I think that'd be really fun.
I think so too. And they might actually that be would... willing to do it, given what we
yeah,
just heard.
Yeah, I... Yeah, so at time of recording, episode 205 came out, I think, like 2 days ago.
Yes.
And that was the first episode with them coming back from Adepticon, and we got a couple shout-outs and talked about. Ben thought it was hilarious because the Saturday before they were... Or no, they were recorded that time on a Saturday, and you and I were in the chat planning out what time we were going to get together
that
to
was,
record
yeah.
this episode.
Yeah, it was yeah. neat to... So Ben's... Ben's noted in previous versions that there was something about a podcast, but not having to do with that podcast. So he's really enjoying the meta of everything.
Yeah, I even I was seeing Tim was streaming yesterday, and Big Chuck was in there with him, and he was talking to Big Chuck about how there's a podcast about his podcast now. And I even gave him legally binding permission to play our podcast while he's streaming.
That's awesome.
Yes. I don't think he's going to do that. I wouldn't blame him for that. But, yeah, it's we're getting a lot of support from the PCN people, and it means a lot. It's nice to know that they're enjoying what we're doing as much as we are enjoying what they do.
Yeah, I think we might enjoy them a little bit more than they're enjoying us, and that's okay.
I mean...
They've had 200 episodes to perfect their craft.
Their craft.
We're in episode 3 or 4 right now, and I don't even know how to count because I never learned in high school.
Well, you know what? You don't have to be supernumerate, Dan. It's okay. It's okay. I'm here for you, and I am.
Well, thank you, Rob.
we're doing episode 3 of our show here. We're covering episodes 11 through 15. So if anybody listening has not listened to those from Gapapa, you don't have to. Obviously we're going to cover it.
We'll just tell you what's going on.
I highly recommend.
Yeah.
Exactly. I highly recommend you do.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic show.
Watch it 3, 6, maybe 12 times or listen to it.
Yeah.
Because the early stuff you just can listen to. They didn't even invent cameras at
and
that
then,
point.
No. And then eventually we get to get the video, which is great for some people. It is unfortunate because you start to be able to see Tim's face. And,
it's
you know,
rough.
There's stuff that comes with that. It is. I mean, but you know what? We love him anyway.
It's a beautiful face. I just give him grief whenever I can.
It's like Lucky's face, a face that only a mother could love, and an absentee father.
And how absentee, we're going to figure out. With our input, maybe not so much.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
Hopefully not. I mean, we talked about that a bit, but it's a lot of fun. We obviously we enjoy that show very much. I mean, we can get into it here. We've got, you know, episode 11. It's called Bolts in the Night is the title of it. Before we kind of get into the plot here, I do want to say, though, because if you listen to our last episode, we end on episode 10 where everyone fails a perception check to hear something going on. And then when you listen to episode 11, they don't talk about that at all. So to me, that says that they probably, episode 10 was the end of a session for them.
Yep.
And episode 11 was probably the start of a new one, and they all kind of forgot that they failed all those perception checks and stuff. So keep that in mind. The first part of episode 11 has kind of a recap for episode 10.
Yeah, I do think Dan takes pretty good notes, and he relies, surprisingly, on JB. Not surprisingly from a JB personal standpoint, but if he was relying on Bruno for notes, they'd be in crayon and misspelled. But JB takes really good notes. Bruno
doesn't know how to read or write.
No. Well, yeah, that's true. Most of them don't.
Yeah, I think at this point none of them do.
No.
But yes, so we have start of episode 11. The other thing about this, though, is since this is a new session, I think in the interim, because it was a new session and everything, they've spent experience points. And at this point, we have our first official career change, which is Carl switching to the boatman career from Stevedore.
Well-deserved, too.
Very well deserved. I think it fits his character a bit more. He's going to start getting a lot more into Manan. He's going to become much more about enjoying his time about the river and being close to the river and things like that. So it's very fitting. Alex definitely does a phenomenal job role-playing kind of this journey with Carl.
He really does explore the character very well.
Yeah. They start the session off fishing. They're sailing down the river, they're fishing, and it's at this point, you know, they make some checks, they're failing a lot of them. It's not great, but the one person who's continuously, just over and over and over, she can't make a single check, is Mina. And it's at this point that we find out that Mina's actual full name is Wilhelmina Fisher.
Yep.
Which, I don't know if they had this before all of there, they talk about, I think maybe Danny had that before.
She did. She said it's been on my sheet the whole time, and Dan never looked, is what I remember.
Yeah, she does say that. I don't know if that's just her riffing or not, but even if it's not, you know, I love that. It's a very fitting name with how Mina feels about fish, the town she's from. It's great. It's absolutely perfect.
It gives credence to her backstory of why she's not still at home or in her home village.
It does. And as a GM, I love whether this was on the fly or whether this was premeditated. I love little things like this. I love when players in the middle of a game start to really get into their character, how they work, how they function. I'm going to try and push everybody to that in the show that we're actually doing, which I forgot to mention before the start of the show. But just kind of throwing it out here, we're going to have a new show coming out soon, probably next month in May, where we have several other Patreon members where their names are going to start to get read on the show soon. But Dagna, Iron Maze, you, and Dr. D, who's part of the PCN network, he has a show called Arachne about the game Infinity. He's fantastic. We're going to have a new actual play with all those people coming out. I'm GMing for the Dune RPG system. It's called Heir to Pride. It's a campaign I wrote myself, and then I'm also throwing in some of the pre-made stuff that Modiphius has come out with, but it's going to be a lot of fun, so look out for that, everybody.
So episode 11. So they've been fishing all day, and at the end of the day, they decide that because they're tied up in a part of the river that's not necessarily quite as civilized, that they're going to set watches. And
yes.
Surprising.
Yes. They do have, I think Lucky ends up catching the most fish,
mm-hmm.
if memory serves. I think he succeeded on one check. He failed another. I believe he didn't fortune point the next one because he's out of fate points still. But he fails it, and then he decides, I'm going to try and cast Magic Missile or Dart to try and blast one of these fish out of the water. And then he miscasts. And then he rolls again to try and catch that fish, and he succeeds.
Yep.
It's very funny. Lucky decides, as they're setting up watches, he's going to take the first watch. As everyone's kind of going, okay, that's great, yeah, let's all go to bed, Lucky wants people to stay up and play some cards with him.
So he can swindle them.
Oh, precisely. That's all Lucky does at this point, is he's just trying to get as much over on everybody else as he can. Bruno and Mina decide they're going to stay up. Carl just kind of said no, he's going to get some sleep. He goes down to sleep. And
he's also got assigned third watch, which is the worst.
Honestly, I think, in my opinion, I would hate to be second watch the most, because you go to bed and either I myself would just be laying there the whole time waiting for them to come wake me up, or I would fall asleep and then it would feel like 20 minutes after I fall asleep they come to wake me up.
I get that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lucky plays a few hands with Mina. She's not really that into it. I think he beats her, and he tries to get her out of money. She says no. She goes to bed. Bruno stays up a little bit longer with Lucky, and Lucky tries to lessen his debt with Bruno. He's trying to play with fictional money, and Bruno says no. The main reason for this, though, is because by this point, we did the math, Lucky owes Bruno just shy of 8 gold.
Yep. Even got mentioned in the episode.
It is a significant amount of money, yes. We also find out Bruno just, and again, I love characters just riffing and role-playing these things. Bruno mentions that Lucky has a weird-looking doll.
He did.
And he did, and it's so great because Lucky starts off with saying, first off, don't ever ask me about this doll again. But Bruno then pushes him a little further and says, but why does it look like Mina?
Yeah.
And I wish we had the video for this, because Dan points out how red and embarrassed Tim gets, and it's great. You can hear it in his voice. Yeah. Knowing Tim, I can imagine it. And so Tim ends up writing down some information about the doll and hands it to Dan. And we have no idea what it is. I don't know if it means it's Mina. It could be Bruno. It could be Carl. They mentioned that maybe it could be, its hair could be trimmings from Carl's mustache.
They did, yes.
It's never really announced.
I personally want to believe that the doll started to look like Mina after Rolf's death.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just me.
Yeah, I would completely agree with that. It would make the most sense, but I don't know. They don't really address it. Bruno eventually goes to bed, though, and Lucky has his watch. It's very quiet. And we get our first Dark Whispers. Now, it is not an official Dark Whispers. Dark Whispers is a system in Wofurp where the GM can kind of offer something to a player that's detrimental to the party, and if the player decides to follow through with that, they lose a corruption point. Dan doesn't really explain it as that. I think he kind of forgot that that was a thing in Wofurp. But what he offers is Lucky can lose a corruption point if he does not wake up Mina for her watch.
Which I think Lucky was more than willing to have thought up on his own had Dan not suggested it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That was kind of what I felt like they were going for. And then Dan just thought, wait a minute, I can, you know what, that's so messed up, I would be willing to do this. And then later they find out Dark Whispers are a thing.
Sure.
And it's just, it all works out perfectly. There's a lot of little stuff like that in the show. It's one of the reasons why I enjoy this show so much. Is the story starts to fit the rules as they go along. And I really enjoy that type of thing. I enjoy more narrative systems. And I feel like Wofurp works really well kind of in that gray area between a more narrative system and a more mechanical system, I think would be a good term for it, like, say, 5e.
Well, basically, according to what we talked about a couple episodes ago, I compared it to D&D, wrongly so, whereas D&D's more, you get experience based on combat, more than other things you might do. Yeah, you're going to get experience from completing quests or doing tasks, but you're getting experience from combat. Whereas in Wefurp, you're getting dead from combat more often than not.
I mean, yes, but you also get experience from combat. It's a big thing, though, I think, in Wefurp. And it's very massive, I will tell it from experience with a lot of these campaign books that I've read. The system heavily encourages GMs to really reward people for good role-playing. It has that allocated in every single end of, like, a little mini-adventure where you award experience points, which is not a thing in D&D 5e. I will say, I think part of the problem with purely combat-based experience systems is, if you think about it on a mathematics way, let's say, you know, even in Wefurp, you have these schools where wizards are trained, right? It makes sense that you would have that. People have magic. They need to learn how to control it. If your experience system is solely based off of XP, if that's all you have to do to gain more magical powers is kill other things, number one, all wizards would immediately be evil unless they were really weak wizards. And then it would take you maybe 6 months to become an archmage because you're just going out and killing all these goblins or people.
Yep. No,
I really prefer systems like this where it's much more narrative. It's much more for completing the combat, not necessarily killing the monsters. More for the experience of the combat.
Right. How does your character choose to react to the outcome of a randomly determined situation?
Exactly.
Anyway, back to our protagonists.
I really enjoy Dan throwing out the Dark Whispers here because it comes back to bite them in the ass real hard, and nobody in the party expected it. I love the shock of what happens, because everybody wakes up and the cabin is full of smoke, and it's so sudden that everyone immediately is genuinely confused. We actually get some of the best role playing, in my opinion, so far, because everyone is so confused and immediately alarmed. Bruno is trying to get out of his hammock. He's panicking and he rolls himself up in it more. You know, Carl is being Carl. He's immediately awake, alert. He grabs his boat hook. Lucky is kind of confused and, frankly, terrified. Mina is caught kind of off-kilter.
Yep.
And we immediately go into initiative order because, you know, how quickly are people reacting to this, which works, and also because, spoilers, we're going to get into combat immediately. Carl forces the door to the cabin open. He realizes it's been kind of barricaded as he tries to open it, so he just shoves his way through it. And immediately is just absolutely basted in burning oil as somebody throws a pot of oil on him. Boy, does it happen in the blink of a second. Everybody immediately, you can hear it in their voices when we listen to this, is just thrown off as, oh God, something really bad is happening right now.
I gotta tell you, having listened to it, I was taken aback as a listener. It was that shocking of a situation.
The first time you hear it, you really feel with the players the shock and the pressure. It's very, very well done. It's very well GM'd by Dan in this moment. He's really shining with his pacing of all this. Carl, when he gets all covered in all this oil, he sees there's a man in front of him, but he's not really even paying attention to that. He kind of shoves the guy out of the way, and he jumps in the river, which, yeah, that's...
I thought it was ingenious. Yeah, yep.
I can't blame him. That's exactly what you do. Exactly. So then we go into proper initiative order. Mina goes next, and she, of course, charges this dude that she saw just throw oil on her new friend and gets into this combat with him. Fortunately, they are not blocking the cabin door. Lucky, at this point, is kind of panicking. I believe he's trying to, pry open some windows or something like that. Bruno gets himself untangled out of his,
hammock.
That's the word I'm looking for. Yeah. He gets himself untangled out of his hammock, and he starts crying to wake up Joseph.
Yep. He also goes full Winnie the Pooh at some point in here.
Well, that happens in the next round of combat, yep. But yes. As everyone's kind of fighting, we go into the next round of combat. One of the windows, as Lucky's trying to force it open, on the other side of the boat from him, somebody rips open one of the windows, and we see at this point the windows have been kind of stuffed shut with rags and kind of barred a bit, and somebody throws one open and tries to shoot Lucky with a crossbow. Boy, Lucky has a hard time with crossbows.
Yeah, he does not have a whole lot of luck.
At this point, no.
And no fortune.
That's what happens when you spend all your fate points and only have two of them. So, he kind of gets away at this point, though, because the crossbow misses. I believe he then tries to dart the person out the window. Nothing really happens with that. I think it kind of fizzles out. Bruno tries to jump through the window and gets himself stuck in the window as he's kind of hanging through the window. And I just love it. I can picture him just kind of stuck in this window. He's got his sword out. He's trying to wave it to stab the person. And I can just see him going, just trying to stab the guy. And then the dude's just kind of standing back going, are you done?
With his feet on the inside of the room, just wiggling around.
Yep. Full Winnie the Pooh, no pants on or anything. He's just got a big shirt on. It's great. Mina is still fighting this one dude. Carl is still in the river, but he sees somebody that he recognizes on the shore.
Yes.
And it is, of course, Nexgar guy. The same guy that was trying to kill him in Weisbrook that seems to have been following them all the way from Altdorf, though it doesn't really connect at this point. The combat starts to kind of go a little quickly. Mina starts to really get the upper hand. She gets a lot of advantage. And this is where we have the first kind of, what's the right way to play it? Not necessarily game-breaking, but the rules are still kind of new to the party in so much that it messes with the flow a bit. I feel this combat was very difficult at first. But Mina single-handedly, because the group does not really have the best hold on how advantage works, she just runs away with it. I think by the end of the combat, she has 9 advantage.
Which I think is more than she's supposed to have. I think it's supposed to max at 5. I could be wrong.
I'm not sure if that's in the rule book or if that's a group rule. The big thing is,
yes,
you're supposed to spend advantage. You have to spend it. And if you don't spend an advantage, you lose an advantage. So I don't know. I have to go back to the rule book and reread all this. I don't know if you have a cap on how much advantage you can have. But I know she was supposed to be spending it this whole time. They didn't really know that, which is why she's within the span of like 3 rounds able to build up 9 advantage. It also gets to be a bit difficult. Dan is kind of struggling a bit as the GM with managing whose turn is what, because Mina is getting to hit the guy back a bunch, and I don't think she was able to do that. It's a lot going on at once. It's a little difficult to follow, I'm going to be real honest with you.
And it's but entertaining.
It's combat, you know, that kind of happens.
100%.
It is, because she just starts to full corn possession, just start killing everything left, right, and center.
She is a bit of a barbarian.
Bruno. She is, yes. It really starts to cement itself here, where Mina is definitely the damage dealer in this group. The whole time Bruno is just inside full Winnie the Pooh. Lucky tries to pull him out at one point, and he can't. Bruno is yelling, get the butter. It's great. Lucky runs outside. Mina is chasing down the guy with the boiling oil. He tried to run away from her. She gets an attack. She hits him. He's wounded. She's chasing him down to kill this guy because she's all kinds of pissed. Lucky sees that there's a third person on this boat, and the third person is actually a woman, And she's the one who was shooting the crossbow at him before, and she's trying to get ready with what looks like another thing of boiling oil. He tries to charm her to try and get her to stop attacking them. He's trying to bring the situation down, which means, of course, now that he's trying to make a friend, Mina has to kill the woman. And she does.
Yet another one of Lucky's potential brides cut down in her prime.
Yet again. I just... Mina. Why do you have to be so mean?
Well, it's part of her name is Mean. You can't get Mina without Mean.
Meanie Mina. You are not wrong. We go back to Carl and have what is one of the most cinematic moments in this game so far. And just so great. Where Carl is strangling the crossbow guy, and the whole time he's yelling at him, "Who are you? What are you doing to my life?"
That's a really good impression, I gotta tell you, Rob. I almost thought it was Carl, even if I hadn't seen you.
Thank you. Awesome. Thank you. I work so hard on it. I might even go in back in editing and try and see if I can't fool around with it to try and make it sound more like Alex. It's great.
I don't think you need to touch it. It was as near perfect as we need to get.
At one point, Dan kind of laughs at him just like I am and asks him, you know, "Hey, are you sure you're asking him this question as you're choking him?" And Alex goes, "Oh, you're right. I'm just going to punch him instead." Which, fair enough. So he beats this man unconscious and gives him a critical wound to where now the man is deaf.
It's going to make him harder to question, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
So they capture this guy, right? And which brings us to a clear crossroads for where the party can go. It's one thing when you're fighting somebody and you've killed him. It's another when you've got somebody who's a prisoner. And how do you handle that prisoner?
Yes.
It says a lot.
It's, again, coming from a GM experience, things like this are moments that set a tone, right? Kind of how you're saying. But in particular, something at a moment like this, this is the first opportunity the party has to make a impactful moral decision.
Yes.
Everything up to this point has been pretty black and white. With this, it really helps set the tone for not only how is this one issue going to be resolved, but how are people going to expect the party to act? How is Dan, as the GM, going to be able to prepare for the party's reaction to things in the future based off of how they act in this?
Yep.
So it's a very key moment in the campaign. The party decides that they're not going to just kill him outright. They want to interrogate him, which,
yep,
great, yeah, this guy I'm sure has information. He's been following them since Altdorf, which, again, they still don't realize, which I'll be honest with you is a little disappointing for me. As a listener, even the first time I heard this, I was like, wait a minute, this is the exact same guy from Weisbrook, which they all knew. But Carl saw this guy in Altdorf. This dude has been following them for a long time. I mean, this is several days.
You would think they might ask the question why.
It just, yeah, it doesn't really click for them. However, the man is unconscious right now, so they kind of just strip all the weapons and armor off of him. He has some manacles on him, which is already a bit of a red flag. They use those manacles on him, though, which, in hindsight, I think may have been a mistake, because they don't find a key to the manacles on him. But it doesn't really come back to bite him in the butt, because they decide, let's throw this guy in
right.
a closet. They have a little storage closet because there's no brig. We're going to throw him in the closet and deal with him later. We need to, you know, get the fires put out and get sailing down the river, which Joseph and the other deckhand have come down by this point. They kind of arrive too late to really get involved with the combat, but Joseph is very adamant that, no, we need to get moving. The other deckhand is kind of adamant that, no, it's dark and dangerous, we need to stay here. But Joseph decides he's the captain. Mm-mm, we're moving on. So they do that. Lucky then proceeds to gaslight Mina when she starts yelling at him that he didn't wake her up. And Lucky proceeds to go, well, no, it's not that I didn't wake you up. It's that you just didn't get up for your watch. I woke you up.
Playing it off like she kind of rolled over and then went back to sleep. Yeah.
Exactly. Which, I'll be honest with you, if it was my wife, yeah, that's what she would have done. So I would have believed
you.
Remember,
you know, your wife is going to watch this or listen to this, right?
No, she's not. No, she's not. She doesn't care. And even if she did, she still wouldn't care because, I'll be honest with you, she'd agree. My wife is terrible at waking up when she goes to sleep.
Fair enough.
It's great. So I don't think Carl and Bruno really care about this. They're just kind of like too tired. They finally get Bruno stuck out of the window. And everybody goes to sleep. Joseph and the deckhand, you know, they're going to be on watch. They're sailing down the river, so screw it. Everyone goes to sleep, gets a decent night rest. Carl kind of heals up a bit. He gets very lucky. Tim's lucky. He is very fortunate. He did not have a critical wound from the burning oil, so he has heavy scarring, which is very fortunate for him. As they wake up, first business of the day, they have this prisoner. We have to figure out what we're going to do with the prisoner. And we proceed to get some of the best lines in this show. Even after 205 episodes, I think these are some of the best lines in the show.
Yeah, they were on their game.
Yeah. Lucky and Bruno start talking about potentially torturing this guy. Which, if there were two characters that were going to consider something like this,
Lucky
it would
Bruno
be Lucky
do
and Bruno.
Fit that narrative.
However, it immediately goes into a comedic bit because they then realize, oh yeah, we have all this oil because Lucky says we should, you know, put some of the oil on his feet so he can't run away, which is actually not a terrible idea. But then Bruno says, oh yeah, you're right. We should rub his back and his feet with all that oil. And then maybe some lavender scent in it. It's just,
yeah, I gotta admit, I cringed a little bit during that part of the episode.
I loved it. They then go in and they start trying to interrogate the guy, and they ask who's going to, you know, it's a small closet, but I guess they all can go in there first. And Bruno goes in and he has his whip and he says, I want to crack my whip and intimidate him. At which point Alex says, yes, our Bruno will blot out the sun. Bruno tries to snap his whip and he fails, which makes sense. They're in a small closet. You don't really have the room to whip it. He does, however, caress the man gently with his whip, which I think is worse.
Yeah, the more the cringing went on at that point.
Yeah, it's good stuff. I enjoyed it thoroughly. It's very entertaining to me. Bruno then takes the lead in the interview, and we have Bruno. He asks the guy, what's your name? And we get some good voice acting from Dan for this guy, where Dan, as the guy, you know, he's rough, gravelly voice, and he goes, I'm not going to tell you. Bruno goes, that's a weird name.
It's quick.
They ask the guy a few more questions. Eventually, he becomes a bit more compliant. And, you know, what are you doing here? And the guy says, I'm here for him.
We're here, Carl.
And Bruno goes, who, Carl? And Bruno says, the man says, is that what he told you his name is? And Bruno says, yeah, that's Carl. I've been friends with him for 14 years. Well, then he's been lying to you for 14 years. Damn it, Carl! I can't not hear that and laugh. JB's delivery is just so perfect here. It's great. Everyone, I guarantee you, is just rolling their eyes and dying laughing at this. It's amazing. Eventually, all of the comedy dies down, and we start to find out some real information about this guy. His name is Adolphus Custos. He is a bounty hunter, claiming to have been hired to help Caster Liberung, who which he believes Carl to be, to claim his inheritance. Immediately, Dan doesn't even have people roll, because you just have to think about this for a minute. That's an obvious lie. Carl even calls him out on this and says, if that was the case, why were you trying to kill me and Weisberg?
You're not really helping me, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And the man says, oh, well, you know, that's just your word against mine. Okay, and you're surrounded by a bunch of his friends. Like, do you really think they're going to believe you, who just tried to kill them, over somebody that they've known longer and has tried to protect them? Like, come on,
but
dude.
For all we know,
they then
for
find...
all we know, this guy thinks that this really is Castor Liberum.
Oh, I'm 100% certain he believes that. I have no doubt of that in my mind. The thing is, he's just trying to sell this off as that he's here to help Castor Liberum, and he 100% is not. There's no way he is.
Now, maybe had Carl not trimmed up his mustache, the guy would have thought, well, maybe this really isn't him. But since Carl got his...
He might have given a second until, look,
You know, once Carl got his face looking like a dead version of himself in the woods, you know, that made it a lot easier for the guy to mistake him.
No, 100%, and I think that's kind of a theme with this adventure, is how much is the party in their pursuit of this potential inheritance going to shoot themselves in the foot? And obviously, you know, getting Carl to look like this guy has done that, because right. now they have right. this prisoner. They then remember that they found a note in the gentleman's boot when they were stripping him of his weapons and armor and stuff. The problem is, none of them can read. So they decide, we're going to get this guy to read his own note. At face value, this is a terrible
idea. I don't know why
idea.
He would do it.
Neither do I!
Yeah.
He immediately, when they bring it to him, he's like, wait, so none of you can read? And Bruno goes, yes, we can read. We want to establish some trust with you and, you know, see if you will be honest with us and tell us what it says.
Honestly, not bad.
Credit to Dan here. It's not bad, just the way JB Bruno delivers this. It's so clearly, you know, he's lying.
There's a lot of corn in that beef.
Yeah. Again, peek behind the GM screen here. The information on this letter is important. So what Dan ends up doing is just having the guy just read the note to them. And I get why. It's very important information. It's going to help influence the party. It introduces a larger threat in general, or a potentially larger threat, that kind of helps the party understand that this may be bigger than just them. But from a story perspective, there's no way in hell this guy would read this letter and not lie. Right? There's no way that this man would not immediately go, oh, they don't know how to read. I'm just going to make this shit.
Two eggs, three sides of beef, and a carton of milk.
And a sack of potatoes. And a carton of milk, exactly. It's... Again, I understand why Dan does it. It's important that they know how to read this. It's just, to me, it doesn't flow as well. But I get it. So, what the note says is it is from somebody named QF. The man does not disclose who QF is, but it is dated a month ago, and it describes that Castor Liberung is part of a, quote, previously mentioned secret society that Herr Custos, the bounty hunter, is interested in. And apparently attached to the letter when he received it was a likeness, whether that was a picture or a sketch or whatever, we don't know, of Castor Liberung. The man does not have it with him at that point, and he tells the party that he burned it. Lucky then crit fails an intuition check and completely believes everything this guy says. Everyone else in the party says he's full of crap. Obviously he is. But I don't hate Lucky believing this guy from a story perspective.
I mean, he's young. He has demonstrated himself to be overly impressionable and to fall in line with the wrong side of whatever argument is presented to him.
Yeah, he, at this point, Lucky has a very strong belief in people of authority. He has a strong sense of respect for people in authoritative position. And this man is a bounty hunter. He hunts down criminals on a regular basis. So the character that Tim has established Lucky to be at this point, it makes a lot of sense. I really enjoy it. Tim plays it up. He does a fantastic job with this. I thoroughly enjoyed this bit. Is it ridiculous? Yes. Does it work?
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah, it definitely works.
Bruno then continues the cringe as they go to discuss. They leave the closet. They go to discuss what to do with this guy. And Bruno continues the cringe that happened at the beginning of this episode by caressing Carl with his whip and being like, I can go back in there and do this to him.
It's getting a little uncomfortable.
And Carl is not having it. It's still very funny, in my opinion. But it is a bit ridiculous.
100%.
Eventually, the party decides they're going to turn the man over to the authorities once they get to Bogenhofen. And they discuss what Dan says, you know, they're going to get to Bogenhofen kind of later in the day. It's early morning at this point. I would say maybe 9 or 10 in the morning, depending on how they discuss it. And, you know, they'll be in Bogenhofen by the afternoon. And that is where
episode
we end
12,
episode
yes.
12. Yes. Which I don't know if we missed the name of episode 12. But episode 12 is titled The Man in the Window.
Yes.
For obvious reasons. Bruno was stuck in a window and they had to get the butter. Yeah. Full Pooh Bear. Honestly, I think Full Pooh Bear would have been a better title for this
episode. I don't think it
episode.
Came up in discussion. I think everybody saw that same image, but I don't think anybody voiced it. And Dan does like to take his... He does tend to take his episode titles from something that was said in the episode as often as
this
possible.
This is true. Episode 13 is called A Barrel in Bogenhofen. If you can't tell from our episode title, somebody's going in a barrel and it's a body.
What else are you
going to
put in a barrel? I mean, once the wine's not in there anymore? Potatoes? Yeah,
I guess.
Potatoes. Yeah.
Pickles? I think there's a lot more useful things to go in a barrel,
a person,
to be honest with you, Dan.
Right,
it's not the best part of a person to put in the barrel.
The body.
They arrive at Bogenhofen. We actually get a cool description of the city. We get some cool lore about it. I really enjoyed this. I enjoy whenever Dan, for lack of a better term, nerds out about areas in Warhammer and the description of them and things like that.
Quick sidebar.
I relate to it very much.
Quick sidebar on this. Around the time that these episodes were coming out, Dan was doing some of his best solo work in podcasting, which was his Grim Podcast of Perilous Lore, where he talk about different aspects.
Grim Stream of Perilous Lore.
And I've begun to re-listen to those because I've heard them, but they didn't sink in. And now that I've seen more of WFRP, now that I've seen Warhammer Fantasy, they make a lot more sense. And I'm especially falling in love with the little province of Kislev, because that's where...
Yes, with your lovely bear riders.
Oh, and their vampire friends.
We have been, Dan and I have been working on doing our own, not necessarily a slow grow, but we're trying to set up for us to be able to play Warhammer the Old World. And we found a codex for Kislev for like a fan-made edition. We're looking into playing that. It's a lot of fun.
But to bring this back, Dan's nerding out. He was doing a lot of that at the time, and you can tell how much he really cares about the setting of the scene, the descriptions, the sights, the sounds, the smells, the whatever it happens to be.
Yes. Yeah, I relate to it on a personal level because I do the exact same thing when I'm super into something. I mean, you're kind of doing it with me right now, Dan. That's why we have this 100%. Podcast. Dan finishes kind of wrapping up this lore. It's on the River Bogan. Just some of my favorite bits about that is each major river in the Empire has its own, like, god. So the Ryke, which is the main river in the Empire, it's the biggest, which is where we get Rykeland, is the god of that river is Father Ryke. And then the god of the Bogan, which is where Bogenhofen is on, obviously, is called Bogenauer. Which is just a cool little tidbit. I really like little things like that. You know, you go back in history and especially in Greek mythology, every river, spring, things like that has some kind of minor water deity or a water nymph or something like that looking over it. So I love little things like that in Warhammer. Good stuff. Carl goes to get the prisoner and finds him...
dead?
I guess dead. Yeah. They, you know, he calls everybody in and, you know, something is wrong in here. Everybody kind of looks. Lucky immediately suspects poison. He has a bunch of foam around his mouth. And he starts sticking his fingers in the guy's mouth to see if he has missing teeth.
Oh. Yes. Sure.
I get it.
To see if he had, if he broke one of his tooth. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I get it. But Lucky doesn't have any medical training at this point. Which is why Dan makes it a difficult check, because how would you know that? Like, do you know off the top of your head how many teeth a person has, Dan?
I know how many I have after my wisdom teeth were pulled. But, okay.
There you go. So, eventually... they discuss what to do. And it goes on for a while. It really does. Which, anyone who's played an RPG game before knows, that's what happens in these situations. Is it takes 20 minutes to have a 5-minute conversation in game, and it takes 5 minutes to journey 7 days. And then combat takes 3 hours to do 10 minutes.
But that's the fun part. You want to enjoy that as much as you can.
I mean, that's true. That's true. Dan tries to help the party out here as the NPC, just the deckhand that's on the boat with Joseph. And he kind of is walking by and he tells him, I mean, look, if it was me, I'd just throw the body in the river. Nobody's going to notice, really. No one's really going to care. The party then... doesn't trust any of this, which I can't blame them for. I mean, you think about it, and you know, Dan has already screwed them over once in this session,
so the players don't trust, you know, it would not GM, be shocking. Which is an important distinction between the characters not trusting the deckhand.
That's true. I think this is when we start to sow the seeds of the bad GM title that Dan is going to receive in a couple episodes. Which he doesn't deserve. He's just playing the game, but still, it's funny. It's been a long-running shtick.
I think he periodically deserves it.
On occasion, he does a few things. But I think in general, he's fine. As the party is talking, they bring up the idea of, well, can Mina maybe do something? She is a soldier. And then Mina, at this point, realizes she never really reported to the regiment she was supposed to go to in Altdorf.
Hmm.
And everybody starts kind of giving her crap about this.
Well, she doesn't wake up for the end of her shift. You know, now she's not reporting into her regiment. She's very unreliable. Yeah. If you listen to Lucky.
She is. If you're Team Lucky, not Team Mina. We get some of the backstory, I believe, in this episode for the first time. We really get the backstory for Mina. We kind of got some of it in episode 0. But the backstory for Mina is she was a town guard her family really didn't want her to. You know, she had all sisters other than the brother that everybody kind of forgotten about that they mentioned in episode one that went to Middenheim. Right. So, but she has all these older sisters. She's the youngest, and all her sisters were much larger women. She's very skinny, and so she didn't want to be, you know, a wife. She wanted to be a soldier. She wanted to be her own person.
Sort of reminds me of Belle.
Yeah, kind of. Kind of. It's very reminiscent of that story. It's a good story. Yeah. I really like the story that Danny came up with for Mina. Yeah. God damn. We find out that Mina had a friend, kind of. She doesn't say he was her sweetheart, but we kind of get that vibe. And he was killed in a Beastman raid. And so she really felt like she didn't have a reason to stay anymore. So she left and she went on her way to Altdorf to join a proper soldier regiment.
Yep. And the Beastman part of that story comes in to solidify further developments in her character that we'll see later on.
It does. She does an absolutely great job with taking the story she came up with. It keeps growing. We're going to, you know, obviously continue to talk about it and track it as it grows. Everybody has these stories that they come up with themselves, and just as they're going through, they start to add on it. And it's one of my favorite things for players to do as a GM. I love when players insert themselves into the world that the GM creates and begin to kind of create their own little bubble within it. It shows that they really are enjoying what they're doing, that they care about what they're doing, that they're just as invested into this game and this story as the GM is. So it's very much to all their credit.
It reinforces the interactive storytelling that is good role-playing.
Exactly. Lucky then pulls a Lucky and suggests that, why don't we just go find a hobo?
Not a terrible idea. I mean, he's had some actually actionable ideas. And the party never seems to go with any of them.
It's really not. Well, they do go with this one. They start out with going with this one. They decide they don't want to just be seen lugging a body around. They're going to go find a hobo. But let's stick the body in a barrel, hire a hobo, and then have the hobo take the barrel to the watch.
See, wait.
Which, I'm going to be honest with you, is it a weird plan? Yes. Is it ridiculous? 100%. Is it actually a solid plan to make sure they get away with this? Oh, 100%. I'm totally here for it.
Yeah.
It's very, very good. They settle on this plan, and then as they, you know, they go find a barrel that has a few potatoes in it. They dump out the potatoes. They stuff in the body. Bruno has to sit on the barrel to properly seal it. And then they start talking again. And they start trying to see, you know, oh, well, what holes are we, are we poking in this plan? What are we doing? Alex, Carl, probably both, just get so fed up with this and just the over-planning, which always happens in these games. That he just decides, screw it, I'm just going to roll this barrel to the nearest watch station myself. So now we're not doing the hobo plan. The party just kind of, oh, crap, and they just follow after Carl. They're walking through the city, and they notice that the city's empty is the wrong word, but it's not as bustling as you would expect it to be, especially with there being a big festival going on that Joseph mentioned, which is the Schaffenfest.
Yes.
Eventually, they come to the town courts. They kind of walk through there. We get some nice description of the town courts in this classic, you know, medieval kind of town hall kind of deal. And Lucky flags down a guard there. And we get another great Lucky line where he goes, hey, Mr. Guard, I have this barrel. Okay. Inside the barrel is a dead man. Oh!
Okay.
So he then explains the entire story to this guard. The rest of the party is just standing there, and I picture them in this story just slowly backing away from Lucky. The guard then clarifies again, well, where did this happen? On the river. Oh, thank God. Yes. He doesn't want
to
deal with
any
of this.
I don't need any paperwork.
He says, exactly. He doesn't want to deal with this. He tries to pass it off to the River Wardens. And Lucky doesn't take the hint. And he keeps pushing it. And then he mentions that the guy was a bounty hunter. And the guard says, is there a bounty on any of you guys? And Lucky doesn't know. So the guard goes, okay, give me a sec. And he obviously goes inside to check the bounty listings. At this point, Carl, Mina, and Bruno just start to leave. They just start walking away. The guard comes back out and talks to Lucky and says, yeah, there's no bounty on any of you guys. I don't know what you're talking about.
Hmm.
And Lucky says, okay. And he then kind of, he catches up to everybody and says, hey, hold on a second. I need to go to Imperial Post and I want to send out two letters. And the pirate says, okay, fine, we'll wait here. Lucky goes to the Imperial Post and he writes two letters. One is to Jaina, the noblewoman's handmaid at the address that Lucky had got from her. The other one he writes to his family, which is in his hometown, which later we will find out the name for his hometown is Wittgenstein.
Wittgenstein.
The funniest part to me about this is I guarantee you nobody in Lucky's family can read.
100%.
So maybe someone in town is going to read it to them?
There might be a doctor in town.
I don't know what the plan was here. Maybe. Maybe there's a doctor in town. Maybe that doctor, you know, treats his family on a regular basis and, you know,
sure,
they can take it to him to read. Maybe they have a friend who can read. That makes sense. Lucky then finger guns and moonwalks out of the Imperial Post.
I think he might actually succeed at this one, right?
He does. He does, yes. The old woman at the counter kind of chuckles a bit. And he catches up with everybody and then tries to scam the party out of money to have him go back into the Imperial Courts to get an affidavit. We talked about this in the last episode. And in the first episode.
Yes.
That Lucky has an affidavit. At this point, he knows he has an affidavit.
And he knows the rest of the party needs it.
Because they've talked about.
Yeah.
Yes. And they've talked about that. So this is 100% Lucky just deciding he's trying to scam these people even more.
Well, he's got
to
pay that dwarf back.
I mean, that's true. That's true. But I'll be honest with you, at this point, I'm just kind of getting tired of the Lucky trying to schmooze off of everybody as much as he can deliberately. Well, not even schmooze, because he's not just smoozing or schmoozing.
Schmoozing? Yeah. No, he's swindling. Full swindle mode.
Swindling, yes. Yes. So at this point, I'm just getting a little tired of Lucky swindling everybody and everything. It's getting a little bit old. I feel like it's not really in line with how he acts in every other aspect of his character. I get it. It's fun. It's campy. But I'm a little tired of it by this point. Granted, this is also coming from a GM who has to deal with crap like this on a regular basis from other players.
Nothing Tim/Lucky ever does annoys me even a little.
You got something a little brown there on your nose, Dan. You need to wipe that off, buddy. I have it written down here as Mina/Danny.
Yeah.
Because I think Danny is kind of with me on this.
I don't think that's inappropriate.
Where she's just sick of this shit.
No, Mina's definitely shutting it down.
She's just sick of it.
And I think Danny's getting a little up to here with it too, yeah.
Yeah. They decide at this point that they're going to split the party.
Which never goes poorly.
Lucky and Carl. No. Lucky and Carl go to the town courts. They're going to get the affidavit. Bruno and Mina say that they're going to deliver it to the River Wardens.
Technically.
I mean, they, in a way, kind of do.
Sure.
They end up just taking it, and Mina and Bruno are talking as they roll the barrel towards the River Wardens and say, we're just tossing this to the river, right? And Bruno goes, oh, yeah.
Yep.
And they do. They go back and meet them at the town courts. Carl and Lucky were not able to get an affidavit. They find out that because of the Schaffenfest, everything government-wise is severely understaffed right now. Most people are working in some aspect at the Schaffenfest. There are courts set up in Schaffenfest. I should clarify a few things here. When they say courts, they don't necessarily just mean criminal courts. There are those. There is that thing. They'll meet a judge later and this whole kit and caboodle. But they don't mean just, you know, gavel, you're guilty, not guilty. They mean anything having to do with administration, taxes, settling disputes, yes, criminal courts. All of that is set up at the Schaffenfest.
Official business.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So everyone decides, okay, let's go there. And they set off towards that, and that's where we end episode 13. And the next one is episode 14, the Schaffenfest.
Now here, you said it before. This is another one where I think we're seeing the beginning of a recording session at 14.
Yeah, that would make sense, actually, because the first thing that they kind of have in here is that they have the announcement of the Lost Omens podcast.
Another phenomenal listen if you're looking for something to watch or listen.
As they're kind of walking through the town of Bogenhofen, they pass through the temples. I think they call it the Gartenplatz or something like that. It's where all the temples are. I love these descriptions. I love all of the gods in the old world because they're all very unique to Warhammer. It's very, very enjoyable for me because it so heavily influences the lore and how the world has developed, why it has developed the way it has, things like that. As they're kind of walking through town, Carl starts complaining about the laziness and poor work ethic of the town clerks. Yes, oh, they're understaffed at there so they can't witness an affidavit? Come on, this is ridiculous. And I don't think he's wrong here.
Well, Lucky's not having any of it either.
That's true, but yeah. Lucky's not having a lot of anything that inconveniences Lucky in any way, shape, or form.
No. But no, this goes to support Carl's character, right? His work ethic, his character development.
Yes, this definitely does kind of, we again start to see more of this paladin idea from Carl. You know, that's kind of the, not necessarily the build he's going for Carl, but the kind of morally upstanding, I would say, is what we kind of get.
He is definitely the conscience of the party at this point, even more than Mina.
Yes. As they're walking, Carl brings up, you know, hey, you guys deliver that by to the river wardens, right? And Bruno and Mina immediately go, oh yeah, of course we did, 100%. They of course did not. But I do greatly enjoy whenever Mina and Bruno sync up like this, because Mina freaking hates Bruno. Especially later in the series, he gets on her nerves so much, but every now and again we get these little bits where they're just syncing up so great, and it's amazing. I love it. It's so much fun.
The adversary of my adversary is my compatriot.
Exactly. They eventually get to the city gates, and they see that the Schaffenfest is outside the city because it is just that massive. It's a huge, huge city. It wraps around three quarters of the city of Bogenhofen. And Bogenhofen is a major settlement. So this is huge. The reason that this festival is so big is because on the last day of the festival, all livestock sales are tax-free. So anyone and everyone who lives around Bogenhofen, whether in the city or around it, herding livestock, anything like that, this is the time to go there because the Empire's not taking its cut.
All right, so hear me out on this. I'm having a hard time understanding why anybody would do any trading before that last day. I would think you might trade 20 sheep or 10 sheep, but if you're going to do a big deal, you're kind of holding off until the last day of the festival, at which I wouldn't think would make a whole lot of sense for fostering the whole inner community and sales and all that during the fest itself.
Yes, but keep in mind it's just the livestock that is tax-free on the last day. So all of the other people there are selling things that aren't necessarily tax-free. Maybe there's other deals that are going on. But it's a big party because you have all these animals coming to town, and you have this big festival that's being thrown to celebrate that and everything. And that's attracting so many people that if you're, say, an herbalist, there's a lot of people there. You might as well try and go sell all your herbs there, because there's more people there at that time over the span of, I think, 3 days, it might be seven, that, you know, are probably more people than are ever in your village at any point of the year.
You've convinced me.
So they kind of walk through the festival. They're kind of learning about some of the things that are around. There's a menagerie. There's some boxing. There's a fortune teller, all these kind of things, just as they're walking around, kind of taking things in. They haven't decided what they want to do yet. But they do talk to some people, and they learn a really important piece of information that the emperor has put out a new decree. And the decree has declared that officially there are no mutants in the empire. Which is, of course, ridiculous. It doesn't make any sense.
Well, maybe where the mutants are is not technically the empire then. You know, that space that they're inhabiting is technically, well, they're inhabiting it outside of the empire.
I mean, maybe. I think more the point of this is the practicality, because the way it's actually written out in the decree, now obviously none of the party can read, but they kind of learn this through talking to people, is that what it means is that people can no longer kill or exile someone that has a physical deformity. And if you do, it is now punishable by death.
Now, this comes back to something, some rumors we had heard earlier about the emperor himself potentially being a mutated individual, or one of his family being so.
It does. We talk about this a little bit in episode zero, though. And this is why, personally, I think that would be a terrible idea. And a lot of people think that would be a terrible idea. Now, the way it's worded makes sense. You know, don't kill someone just because they have a physical deformity. You know, just because someone has a club foot doesn't make them a mutant. Yes. And if that person is not a mutant, killing them is terrible and a horrible thing. 100%. In our world, this decree makes sense. In the Warhammer world, it does not. Because they have chaos. They have magic. They have deformities.
They've got the warp gate. Yes.
They have the warp gate. They have all of these terrible things that are such a reality, it makes things like witch hunters a necessary evil. Because they are real. They are tangible. It is a legitimate threat.
And chaos will do evil.
Every time. Every time. That's all chaos does, is evil and mutate and corrupt.
Sometimes it whispers darkly in your ear and tells you to do things that you wouldn't otherwise do.
Like not waking up Mina, and then you get Carl covered in boiling oil.
Yeah. It happens.
It does. It does. It just happened yesterday for them. Or no, earlier today. This is the same day.
Yeah. Technically, it was after midnight, I believe. So Lucky really, really enjoys this idea, though, of the decree. Lucky's wholeheartedly in favor of this.
Absolutely. And that makes sense. You know, we haven't really gotten a lot fleshed out from Lucky's backstory, other than he's poor and from this poor podunk backwoods town. But we do kind of have some hints at what takes shape properly later, where Lucky had a fiance. They kind of said it was a cousin. I would imagine it's a distant cousin. But he has a cousin, and he was engaged to this cousin, and she mutated the day before his wedding. And I believe he actually makes this the catalyst for Lucky deciding, that's it, I'm done, I'm out of this town.
Okay.
And so Lucky has always been very sensitive to mutants. He references on several occasions that a lot of the people he knows mutate. And it's a constant thing with him, and he hates it. He is really sympathetic to mutants. So it makes sense that he would be supportive of a decree like this. as they're kind of walking around and they're hearing all these rumors and discussing these things, they smell alcohol and just this really bad stench, and they hear this gross burp, and they see this drunk dwarf that's put in some socks out in front of this large group of tents and things like that. And Lucky immediately, you know, he wants to talk to everybody, so he goes and talks to this dwarf, and he is a dwarf named Gotri. He's very gross looking, he's got a big bone in his beard, he's very dirty, covered in mud. As they're talking to him, some kids run by and throw eggs and tomatoes on the dwarf. It's really gross. Lucky is very much a bleeding heart. It plays on him very much. And the dwarf says he needs some money to get out of the stocks. Lucky doesn't have it. But he does say he will buy the dwarf a drink later. And the dwarf then says, okay, I want Bugman's quadruple X.
Hmm.
Which is like asking for a bottle of the finest champagne. It's pricey. It's the finest dwarven ale. So, obviously, that's not great. Mina goes on a bit of a rant at this dwarf, trying to shame him for asking for something so nice while he's in the stocks and can't even afford to, you know, get out of it. But the dwarf is so drunk, he doesn't really care.
Well, and I think the dwarf may have some foreshadowing in mind. You know, if it's going to be potentially, you know, if he's in a bad situation, you might as well go for something nice if it may be your last opportunity for such.
I mean, that's fair. What's that old saying? Shoot for the moon. Even if you miss, you'll land among the stars.
Exactly.
They pass by another tent that smells kind of sickly sweet. It smells real different. They go inside and find out this is an apothecary or an herbalist, kind of a mix between the
and
two.
And maybe she knows Lucky's dead.
Yes, you're right. That's kind of the thing that makes Lucky go, oh, I definitely want to go in here now. So he goes in and they meet the apothecary. Her name is Elvira. She's a very lovely woman, very polite. Dan roleplays her wonderfully. And this is a good opportunity for Dan as a GM and just to introduce the party in general to how poultices and healing drafts and things like that, how they work. Lucky asks Elvira about his dad, who at this point we have a second name for. His name is Dr. Dregs, but also he goes by Cricket, which is probably his actual name. Elvira says that the name sounds familiar. She thinks she has sold things to his dad in the past, but she doesn't know him. She hasn't seen him lately. She doesn't know where he is. It's also at this point where I think the seeds are kind of starting to get planted for Lucky to become interested in herbalism. He starts to kind of, his interest gets piqued because he sees how much, honestly, I think the thing that starts it is he sees how much money can potentially be made in these things. I believe a healing draft is like 5 or 6 silver. There, things are expensive.
And obviously she's doing well enough to have a tent in the Schaffenfest, the extravaganza that is that. So she must be doing something well. You know, I think he's honestly impressed.
Yeah, she has a tent in the Schaffenfest, and she also has a proper shop in Weisbrook, which she invites them to come to, and Lucky makes the comment of, oh, well, I don't know if we'll go back there, because, you know, I almost got murdered twice there, but, you know, maybe if we do, I'll see you. They also, as they're walking around, they spot a joust. I have a rant about this.
Please.
We have another pink behind the screen for this campaign. This joust gets on my nerves a lot. Because in the book, it explicitly says this is a joust between these two noble houses. The party cannot participate or take part in it whatsoever. And then right after that, it gives you a hook for trying to get the party to take part in it.
So your beef is with the crafting of the module.
Yes, because as I mentioned before, I'm running through this campaign with some friends of mine and my wife. One of my friends is playing a Bretonian or half Bretonian knight. Bretonians obviously always want to joust. That's their whole thing, is they're that classic high medieval, you know, fantasy type deal. So, of course, if there's a joust, he wants to be a part of it. as I was reading through this book and preparing to play this with my wife and her and our friends, it gives me this whole description of it. It's very nice. Obviously, my friend's going to want to be a part of it. And then it says they can't be a part of it, but then it gives me a plot hook. It's very confusing. I think to a new GM, it's going to get frustrating, especially because I had to work this into my campaign. It is 100% something my party's going to want to do. It's going to suck for them if I don't have this in there.
Sure.
So then I go and I try and find rules for jousting in Wofurp. Even now, years after this happening with, you know, them starting the game and everything like that, there's no actual rules for jousting. It's kind of weird. So I will kind of explain here how I came up with that, just for anyone who's listening, if they want to kind of work that in there. Because the system I came up with, I think it works very well. What I did is, when they start to go at each other, you know, everybody gets on their horse and everything, that you do a ride check. And the reason you do this is, I learned when I used to fight in Renaissance fairs, I used to do HEMA tournaments. And so I'd go to Ren fairs all the time. There was jousting sometimes. I knew several guys who were jousting, and they taught me some stuff. So you do the ride check at the beginning, because one of the most important things when jousting is you need to get your horse going at the proper speed. If your horse is going too fast, you don't have enough time to properly set your lance. If your horse is not going fast enough, then you're not going to get the momentum you need to properly hit your opponent to possibly either knock them off their horse or to aim right, so on and so forth. So you start with the ride check when everybody kicks off and gets their horses going. If they succeed, that gives them some advantage. They can then use that advantage to hit the other person.
Like a pole arm check?
Yeah, so they have a melee pole arm, or I think it's melee cavalry. So you use that skill, whatever you think is appropriate, you know, and you just keep going. You have a point system. You know, if they unhorse the opponent's out and they move on to the next round. If they hit the opponent just in the body or wherever, that's a single point. If they hit them in the head, that's 2 points. First, I guess, opponent, player, whatever you want, the first person to get 3 points wins the round and either moves on or does not.
And that way it's much like fencing. Yep.
Yes. Exactly. It's a very simple system. I highly recommend you guys use it. I greatly enjoyed it. My party greatly enjoyed it. There you go. Use that in your games as you will. It's a lot of fun. Going back to the Gapapa game, spotting the joust prompts Mina to give us another story about Uncle Chet. And I love this one because it's about boat jousting, a sport that Uncle Chet tried to get started in CSDOT. And I love it. I love it. The way she describes it, it's exactly what you think. It's two guys get on a boat and they try and knock each other off the boat with paddles. And it's hilarious. It's amazing. I love it. It's great. It's wacky. It's kooky.
It's Uncle Chet.
Yeah. The party goes to the town courts and they get rebuffed.
I think the courts tell
them,
we're too busy with the affairs of the Schaffenfest to be doing this, which we'll be happy to do for you after the Schaffenfest.
Exactly. There's no reason why you can't just wait these few days. You even said that you have a boat that you can wait on. Yep. So you don't have to pay for an inn or whatever. Just stop it. Which, fair enough. They then decide, okay, let's go look for some food. And Lucky buys some bread rolls. And he says that he wants to buy a few extra bread rolls so that he can give some to the dwarf. It's very, very nice, very sweet of him. We get more of this bleeding heart Lucky, which I love. Especially because I was just mentioning earlier that I was starting to get tired of Lucky's shit. I'm so tired of this scamming and swindling thing. I really hate when people do these kinds of things because I don't think it's hard in life to be kind to other people. And I think deliberately trying to swindle other people is just so mean-spirited.
In his defense, I think Lucky only really tries to swindle people he thinks, one, can afford it, or two, have done him a disservice. So I don't think he's necessarily mean to people in general. But he's not real happy with Mina right now. So I think when he's trying to swindle, especially
this
her,
is true.
It's an ongoing narrative in his head, whether it's right or not.
This is true. This is true. It's just, especially considering how much later in the story I love Lucky, this just really digs under my skin, as anybody listening can hear. So as they're kind of walking around, they eventually come to this really dark blue tent. Dan gives a great description of it. I didn't write it down exactly because, frankly, you guys should be listening to those episodes. Yep. And you should hear Dan describe it. He does a wonderful job. He's very good at this.
He paints a nice picture.
He does. And so they go into the fortune teller and everybody gets their fortunes told. I didn't write down all the fortunes. Again, because I think you kind of need to experience this yourself. The way Dan voices this, the way he role plays it, the way the party role plays it is very, very well done. If you want the experience, let me rephrase this. You need to go experience this yourself. It is fantastic. It really shines how good all of these people are at what they're doing. It's very, very well done. It's very near Critical Role level in quality of role playing and acting by everyone involved. It's wonderful. We get a few different reactions from everybody. First off, Carl is terrified of all of this. And we really cement this idea here that Carl does not like anything not natural. And he doesn't consider magic natural. So he's very scared. And I love this idea because Carl is this big, strong, morally upright, tough dude. And he's absolutely terrified of this little old lady fortune teller. It's great. Mina is the first one to get her fortune told. Carl goes next and is very, very scared. He, as he's kind of paying the lady to get his fortune told, tells her, not too scary, please.
I don't want to be too freaked out, you know?
Yeah. Bruno goes next. And then finally we have Lucky at the end. And there is no way on God's green earth that this lady did not figure out that Lucky was a witch when she does this. Dan has her react in such a way that it's very, very clear to him, to Lucky, but not to the rest of the party. And it's so well done. Again, if I haven't stressed this enough, go listen to this episode. It's so good.
100%.
Oh, fantastic. I love it. And that's kind of where we end off episode 14. Which is, you know,
not a witch. He's
again titled The Schaffenfest.
Yes.
Yeah, he's not a witch. He's not a witch. He's a wizard now. He's got his papers.
All legal.
We then go into episode 15, which is titled Carl Makes a Friend. We have the beginning of the sheep noise whenever someone says Schaffenfest. So either Dan and I will do that from now on whenever someone says Schaffenfest. Meh. Everyone then, as they're walking around, they're, you know, okay, well, what do we want to do now? And we have Dan doing what is, again, just some great voicing of people walking around going, sweet breads. I have to give a little backstory to this. The other night, as I was listening to this and I'm taking my show notes, I'm in here with my wife in the office. She has her desk and her computer on one side. I have mine on the other. I'm listening to it. I'm just vibing. I'm having a great time. And I just randomly, when Dan says that, I sing it out and go, sweet breads. And my wife just starts dying laughing. She almost fell out of his chair because I had been quiet for so long. And I just randomly sang that out and scared the crap out of her. But it was so funny. She had to laugh. It was great. I love these little things like that. It's great. It then prompts a very lengthy discussion in the episode about what are sweetbreads and what are sweetmeats. Because sweetbreads are organs. And sweetmeats are pastries.
And to be honest, I would have thought it went the other way.
Exactly.
It sounds like it should go the other
way.
Yeah.
It would. And so that's what Dan meant, is he meant sweetmeats, but there's a few sound bites out of these episodes that I really want to go back and ask Tim for. And I think Dan saying sweetbreads is one of them. Maybe if I can get that from him, we'll play that at the end of the episode or
something. We also got to get Carl doing the horse whisper, too.
Oh, God. Yes. We need to get a couple of those. They end up deciding they are going to head to the menagerie. And we get more of the discussion about the lewd zoo. And Carl is very pleased that the animals will be wearing underpants because he doesn't want to see their junk flying out. And he doesn't like normal zoos, especially the one in Altdorf, because it's just too inappropriate.
Yeah, he's kind of prudy. It's showing through. I don't know how he's going to make a Carl Jr.
I don't either. And that's something that comes up later and why, you know, we talked about this a bit before. I think it's important to maybe get a couple sessions in, get a couple episode, well, episodes in this case, but get a couple sessions in with your party if you're playing this game for the first time before you have them write down their motivations. Are they missing out on getting some resolve back and things like that? Maybe. You know, maybe just go a little easy on them for the first few sessions, help them out a bit. But it really helps with figuring out what a character's motivation is. It really helps the players get into a mindset of a character to be able to figure out key questions like that. Motivations, ambitions, who this character is, what they actually want.
Okay. Let me interject here real quick, because we're mm-hmm. going into discussing episode 15. We've begun to talk about it. Mm-hmm. I don't know that it was clear from Dan or from the party to this point that he had told them that their fortune had been refreshed. I don't know if he had given them back any replenishment of fortune or resilience, whichever it
is. So resilience and resolve are you gain those back by completing your motivation,
right? But you should
fate
be getting
fortune you get. Yeah. Yeah, you should begin that back on a regular basis. That's why it's important to have the motivations, you know, figured out early on mechanically. That's a good point. We run into a unique issue in this game, or rather the players and Dan do, where because they're doing multiple episodes and things like that, it's a little trickier for them to get their fate and fortune. The way it's described in the rulebook is that at the start of every session, you get your fortune back. The problem is, I think the length of their sessions varies so much, and how often they're doing it varies so much, that Dan kind of has to specifically decide when he's going to do that, and he forgets. Which, fair enough. By our math, I think they've had maybe four at the most sessions yet.
I don't think it's more than four.
So, yeah it's running into, I believe by this point he's given it back to them. I don't think we've marked it because it's such a small thing.
Sure.
But yeah, maybe he has, maybe he hasn't. It's a running theme in this. We'll kind of document that better in the future. But it is a point that's made in these early episodes, is Dan just forgets.
He is a bad GM.
Which I can't blame him for. He's a terrible GM. I will say I feel his pain as a GM, because I would have the exact same problem. There is so much that GMs have to keep track of that a lot of people, if you've never GM'd before, don't even realize. You have to track the story itself. You have to plot out all these variable paths that your party might take. You then have to be able to improvise on the fly, because I guarantee you, if you plot out six roads that your party can go down, they're going to find a seventh, and then they're going to go down an eighth.
Yes.
So there's all of that. You have to understand, especially with Wefurp, you have to understand the Warhammer world semi-decently. Dan clearly does. But you then have to be able to put in perspective every action that the party does. You have to understand how the world flows around the party so you can react appropriately to them. There's a lot going on. And then on top of that, Dan is having to remember to refresh this core mechanic that he isn't supposed to have to manually refresh himself. So I feel for him.
Okay. I'll forgive him.
Yeah. As they're heading to the menagerie, they pass by this boxing ring, and they kind of stand off to the side to watch it for a bit, and there's this big, really muscular dude that's boxing in there. You know, he's got rope tied around his hands and arms. And there's a ringmaster up there. They see this dude just knock out one guy, and there's a ringmaster comes into the ring as they're dragging out the unconscious dude, and he says, "Ah, that's, you know, very well done. This is Crusher, everybody. Anyone else want to step into the ring? 3 gold if you can last 3 minutes in the ring with my champion. 3 minutes and you get 3 gold. And we've mentioned this before. A single gold piece is probably what a typical person will make in 2 months. It's a very large sum of money. So this is not a small amount that this man is offering for people to take a chance here. And then he spots Carl, because Carl stands out. He's big, he's muscular, he's got this red mustache. And he says, "You, sir, how about you? You look very strong and tough. You just need to last 3 minutes in the ring here with my friend, and you can, you know, win 3 gold. More money than you've probably ever seen in your life." He doesn't say that, but...
And this is an honorable thing as far as Carl's concerned.
It is. It is. And Carl decides, you know what? Yeah, let's give it a shot. He pays, I believe it's 2 silver to get in the ring with Crusher. And they start to go at it. And Carl actually does pretty well in the beginning. He's doing real good against this guy. And he starts to realize that the other guy isn't actually trying to beat him. He's trying to put on a show. And so Carl picks up on this, and of course, being Carl, he tries to play along with it. He's just trying to have a good time. This guy's trying to have a good time. Let's put on a show. Right. He starts flexing his muscles. He starts trying to pump up the crowd by shit-talking the guy, but he doesn't really know how to shit-talk. It's great. It's very, very fun. However... things take a turn when suddenly the guy just tries to one-shot Carl. And he does. He very much does. And so, unfortunately for Carl and Alex and Dan, frankly, I feel for Dan in this moment, Crusher gets a critical hit on Carl. Now, I'm going to be honest with you here. If I was Dan, I would have fudged this dice roll a bit. This is not an important enough moment for it to be worth getting a critical hit on Carl and possibly causing serious damage. I understand that Dan's, you know, just going with what is happening, right, but I probably would have fudged it a bit here, just for entertainment value. Because unfortunately, Carl, Alex, he has to spend a fate point to not be crippled for a month and a half. It's been 4 days in this campaign.
To be honest, I do think that that Dan has gone easy on them quite a bit, and I think he's probably feeling a little bit of that, which is probably why he does not go easy in this situation. I got to give him a little bit of leeway.
Yeah, that's true, and I feel that. Yeah, I just, again, we're running into another little bit of a different GM style here. Again, he's not doing anything wrong. He's not bad. He's not, you know, there's nothing wrong about this. It's just a difference in style.
Right.
This is also why I'm called the good GM and he's the bad GM. So he still gets hit really hard. Like, basically, he almost cripples Carl, and it's very obvious. The Ringmaster even comes in. Crusher helps him up. The Ringmaster comes in. He gives him his admission money back for this. And Crusher feels terrible. He even offers to buy Carl a drink later. He feels awful. The whole point of this was to put on a show and make some money, not to hurt people. And Carl finds kind of a kindred spirit with Crusher in this. And it's very, very sweet. It's a good moment. We have, again, some great role-playing here by everybody. It's wonderful. They all agree with this. I have an honorable mention here because I just love this bit from JB that kind of turns into a bit of a running shtick where the whole time Carl is fighting Crusher, Bruno is on the sidelines, kind of leaning over the ring, just yelling, "Carl, windmill! Windmill, Carl! Windmill! Windmill! Come on, Carl, windmill!" And it's just, it's so great where that's all Bruno knows of fighting, is just try and smack people with the sword, whip people, or windmill.
So if you've ever seen the Rocky that's movies, I'm kind of mm-hmm. seeing... I'm kind of seeing Bruno as
Mick?
No, not Mick. I'm thinking Rocky's brother-in-law. I don't even remember his name, to be honest. But hit the one in the middle. Yeah, hit the one in the middle.
Yeah, yeah. See, my mind went a completely different route of Carl in a ring, and he's just sitting there, "Oh, you've got to cut me, Bruno." And Bruno goes, "Okay." And he cuts his, cuts his leg with a knife or something. Just, "No, that's not what I meant. Oh, sorry."
Paulie. Paulie's the guy's name. That's who I was thinking of. Anyway.
It's great.
But it was a great scene.
After all this happens, they agree to go meet Crusher for a drink. And they eventually finally get to the menagerie. And as they're at the menagerie, they spot a dwarf kind of working in one of these cages. And they see something in this cage that looks like a goblin. But it kind of freaks them out for a minute because they realize that the goblin has three legs. And unfortunately, that's the end of episode 15. Which means... we can't really go into how much I relate to a three-legged goblin.
Tell us.
So,
tell us
unfortunately,
more.
This... No, I can't. My wife will get mad at me. So we're going to have to call it here, everybody. And we will see you next time.
Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you indeed. Goodbye. Good night. Good morning. Whatever time it is good for you. Mate. Don't think about the three-legged goblin. Don't think about a three-legged hobbit.
On that note.